Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and we continue our celebration of that with writers Rowan Hiseu Buchanan and T. Kira Madden, who discuss their writing habits and contributions to the book Go Home, an anthology of Asian diasporic writers musing on the notion of home. This conversation originally took place March 12, 2020, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. Fun fact, this was our last in-person program before the pandemic, and the title of the book we discuss is Go Home. We couldn't make this stuff up. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're really excited tonight to present this program in our My America series in conjunction with our special exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. And it brings together more than 30 different writers from all over the world who came to America, and we asked them about their experiences as writers and also their relationship to the idea of America and what America means to them. Tonight we're going to be talking to T. Kira Madden, who's the author of Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls and founding editor of the No Tokens Journal, and Rowan Hiseu Buchanan, whose novels include the upcoming Starling Days. And she's the editor of the anthology that we're going to be talking about tonight a little bit, called Go Home, a collection of writing by Asian authors writing about what home means to them. Welcome to both of you. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Yes. We corralled ourselves a lot. Yes. We're very grateful to you.
We'll all go through the Lysol shower in the van. Yeah. So I wanted to start tonight by asking you, you know, the name of the book is Go Home. I wanted to start by asking both of you what your idea of home is and what are the forces that shaped that idea for you both.
Sure. This is an answer that changes for me all the time, and I think we've talked about this through Rowan's whole process with this anthology, and I think I had a different answer then than I would have now even. I don't remember what that was. But for me, I think home is community and home is people. I've never really found my place as in a physical place because I was born and raised in South Florida, particularly Boca Raton, Florida, in which I never felt a sense of home at all. So I think throughout my life and through the years, I have found my people in different ways. I found my people culturally. I found my people in the writing community. I found a hop of people like myself, like Rowan. And that feels like home when I'm with those people, as corny as that might sound.
That was really beautiful. So I'm also mixed race. My mom is half Japanese, half Chinese, but she grew up in America. My dad is a bunch of white people from Britain. I mean, one white man, but, you know, history. And I've lived in America, and I've lived in the UK, and so I share a slight feeling of geographical lostness. And I talk in the opening of this book how, for me, for a long time, I didn't feel like there was a place that was home. What I don't say is, like, I'm a wuss, and, like, I'll be really sad, and I don't want to go home. And my friends will be like, you are at home. What are you talking about? But I had this idea of this ideal home, a place where you felt safe and like you belonged. For me, it sort of came in two different ways. One was books. I mean, I'm a nerd. I collected books by mixed race writers, by Asian American writers, by writers who felt like outsiders for other reasons, by queer writers. Like, I was like building myself a family of books. And as I got older and was able to make choices more about where I lived and who I knew, some of those writers became real writers. I knew real life were very wonderful, and some became friends who don't write. And so for me, home has always been an effort. It's been like a verb. It's been a thing you do, a thing you seek out, rather than like just a geographical place, I guess.
How did both of your backgrounds influence your writing career?
I think most people of color or writers who've been marginalized in some way, I think many of us share the experience of not seeing ourselves represented on the page growing up. Those people have always been writing. I don't want to say that now we're having a moment that we didn't have before. Those people were always writing their stories and always making space for people like us who came later. But I think we can all agree that perhaps the curriculum we were assigned growing up did not reflect lives like ours, did not maybe reflect mixed race people, marginalized people, queer people, in a way that now, after, I like what you said about finding family in books, but that takes time and that takes community. And I hope younger generations, they might not have to wait as long because they'll have people like us pointing to it. But I didn't have that growing up. I grew up with Gone with the Wind was my text that I read. And I don't, you know, I can see now, you know, yes, this text is problematic, but it's also what made me interested in reading, and I'm grateful for that, but I'm more grateful for finding, you know, people like us to see that visibility, to find it, and to then, I hope, amplify that visibility by not being a pundit or the one person who is X, Y, and Z, but to speak and write into a chorus of people who have felt not represented in art in that way. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, I think when I was given the opportunity to edit this book, so much of what I wanted it to do was not to be like this definitive, like, best all of Asians, and like, now there's no more room for you. We have taken it and won. You know, I wanted it to be.
It should have been called Best of Asians.
Not even Best Asian Writing, Best Asian.
And I wanted it to be a door, and I did. Like, that was huge for me, that, like, I was trying to build, like, a mini version of my bookshelf, kind of a mini version of the bookshelf that I found really exciting, so that I hoped that people would come to this book and they want to write their own stories, they want to write what's missing, but also they'd read, like, there's an essay of T. Kiris that's in here that at the time wasn't available, but now is also in her memoir, so that they read it and go, oh my God, I love this writer. This writer really speaks to me. I'm going to seek out more of her work. And so I hope that some of what's here does that. So I guess this is a plug for my anthology. But and I think as a writer, I find it really hard to know. I think one of the things I struggle with is that this is what I am. Like, sometimes I want to be able to explain what it is to be mixed race to people. I always was. I often don't even understand where I end and it begins. I was listening to Celeste Ng talk about, who's not mixed race, she's Asian American, talk about her cutlery drawer at home and how there was never enough room because there is enough space for forks and knives and spoons and teaspoons, and she has chopsticks. And I thought I was really bad at organizing my cutlery. Like, genuinely, I just thought I was disorganized. And I was like, no, that's not why. And so I think that's also what a community does for you. It lets you know where you're from. Sorry, that was a bit of a side note. So yeah, it's hard to know what it, but I think maybe what it is as a writer, it makes me very interested in outsiders and outside voices and people who are trying to understand the world.
How, what do you feel your relationship and responsibility is to the communities that you identify with, that you feel yourself a part of, in terms of, do you write for those specific communities? Do you find that influencing the process?
That's a great question. I find thinking that way I feel like I can't manage that personally. So I always have to push that away when I start feeling like I'm pandering or writing for a large community. It makes me feel like, oh, I'm trying to be a pundit in some way, and I'm not. I'm not the one voice that can speak to biracial lesbian experience, biracial lesbian Jewish experience, even though, you know, to me growing up, that felt like highly unique. I think the best I can do, and this is not the answer for everyone making art, but I can just imagine one person I'm writing for at a time. And sometimes that changes piece by piece, and sometimes that changes by genre. But for the most part, it's usually, it sounds silly, but it's a kid version of myself. I have a little picture of the little kid me, and I think about how can I offer grace to that person's experience who didn't have the resources that I have now, who didn't have the community or the home that I have now, to make that experience of child abuse, of sexual assault, of isolation, worth something in this world. And it's writing for her the stories that she was trying to tell at the time, and writing them now in a way that I hope I can offer integrity and grace to those stories. So I can't think about that whole community, but I think if I'm writing honestly with vulnerability for that person, I am writing to that community, because those are the stories we kind of wish were bomb for us growing up.
Every time she talks, I'm like sit and think about it. But then I was like, I have to say something. So I think for me, because I'm primarily a fiction writer, though I do write essays, and my essays probably are more directed, but my fiction comes almost like a dream or like a movie in my head. And when I am first writing, I'm writing for the characters, I'm writing for what would feel true for them. And like sometimes the main character of this book, Starling Days, is a bisexual Chinese American woman who's in a relationship with a mixed race man. And so sometimes that touches on community, but it's also like them specifically, their specific experiences. And like, I have to believe that they're real almost when I'm writing it. I have to have, otherwise it starts to feel like a trick or fake. But I think sometimes later when I'm coming back, when I'm editing and I have to make a difficult choice, I think about that community. So in this book, she falls for, she's married, and she falls for another woman. And my agent said, it's a bit difficult that that happens. What if it was like a sexy friendship instead? And I had this moment of like extreme self-doubt where I thought, well, I want this book to be in the world. Does it have to be a sexy friendship to be in the world? And I thought about all of the women I knew personally who'd come to their sexuality later in life, it gave me strength to write it. I'm not saying this novel is the only way to do that. I think you're right, there is a very big danger in saying my story is the story, but I think there's that aspect. And similarly, I think I find that when I'm often writing to those identities, I'm writing towards vulnerability, which is something that really interests me. So my first book, Harmless Like You, is about a Japanese woman who abandons her son and how and why that happens. And it's also a lot about feeling like an outsider and trying to find your place. And my editor is a blonde woman with blue eyes. And she said, oh, this book spoke to me so much because I came from an English family, but I grew up in Scotland, and I was a weird person, and then I came back to England, and I felt Scottish, and I didn't know where I was from, and I didn't in my head think I'm writing for this blonde woman who feels like an outsider, but I realized I was writing for people who felt that.
That makes sense.
In whatever context,
yes,
they felt that, yeah.
And I also think people will always do that for us. People will, there's comfort in categories, right? So people will say, you know, this is who you are as a writer and who you're writing for. They always do that. These are your topics. This is what you write about.
Your brand.
This is your brand, whatever it is. And people will say, you have a responsibility to XYZ. So I think because of that, I try to push against that as much as possible, because readership will do that. Media will do that.
Yeah. You write about these kinds of things, mm-hmm. and therefore that's, we know where to put you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So
we talked this week. You were generous enough to give your time this morning to some, we had a group of about 80 seventh and eighth graders. And one of the teachers asked a what I thought was a great question, which is, you know, you have all these different identities that claim you or that you claim. What about the identity of writer? How do you feel about that identity?
My answer earlier was that, I think imposter syndrome is really real for most of us. And I think the teacher asked, when did you look in the mirror and see a writer? And I said, you know, I think I felt more like a writer when I was a kid writing my first stories on one of these typewriters than I do now some days. But we both agreed that the way we feel is not the advice we would give to our students. But I think I feel most like a writer and an artist and activist when I'm writing in rebellion of something, which is usually. And when somebody says, you know, you shouldn't write about this thing, or you can't write about this thing, you can't write about this topic, or these people will not be published. When I shift my focus to activism, writing is activism, art is activism, is when I feel like a writer. Like, yes, I will out
the person who has assaulted this other person. I will out people who are doing harm in the world, and I will do my best to uplift voices that are being pushed to the side and told they have no place in publishing. So when I kind of put that blazer on, I feel like a writer. But on days when I'm in my pajamas, you know, just typing away, trying to create a world, I usually feel like, what am I doing? Somehow my book is an accident. I always refer to my book as an accident. I'm trying not to, but it feels that way.
I think, you know, when I was saying the students, and when I tell my students when I teach, is, you know, if you're writing, you're a writer. And that I really, really believe that for people who are not me. I don't think I felt able to call myself a writer until my first book was published, and I could look at it and like see it in bookstores and touch and be like, you're in the world, people are reading you, what does that mean? Anyway, a lot of anxiety. but I think if, I don't know, this audience is an audience of writers, maybe. I think I feel most like a writer in my anxiety. I think about, sometimes I'm like, oh, I need to give everything up, I need to give this up, blah, 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 drama. And basically my best friend just laughs at me and goes, okay then, Roman, give it up, see what happens. And I give it up for usually about 2 days. And I realize although I see, and this is why I give my students advice, when I think of myself as a writer and that being a writer means having a book in a bookstore, I get very frozen out and worried because your words are out there and people are directing them and you don't have control. You can tell I'm in therapy. And, but the reason I come to writing is to understand the world and to communicate the best vision I can of the world to people around me, because I often didn't know how to talk to people when I was a child, and I needed to think and figure it out. And that when that is what makes me write, and that's what begins the process of writing. And so I would like that to be the reason I call myself a writer.
There's an epigraph that opens my book by Ann Carson, The Glass Essay. And it's a part of The Glass Essay, and it says, "You remember too much," my mother said recently. "Why hold on to all that?" And I said, "Where do I put it down?" And that, I think it's not specifically for nonfiction, even though it felt relevant to the memoir, but I think anyone with that feeling, like, where do I put it all down? I carry all this stuff when I'm brushing my teeth in the morning, when I'm showering. It's like all this noise, all this stuff. And I think writers and artists have that in common, this inability to put it down unless we put it into a container that looks like a book or a canvas or whatever that may be.
Into some type of work, that so that you're not only making sense of it for your audience, but you're making sense of it for yourself.
Right. And I think that might sound really obvious to a room full of people who love to read or artists, but I think a lot of people don't deal with that. They don't feel that excess all the time. Just like, oh, I just get through my day. I never thought about that. But there's a rush, there's a crash for us writers, I think, where we need to find something.
There was a story, and I forget how it got started, and maybe one of you read it, about determining whether or not you have an inner monologue, whether there's always a sort of like news ticker in the back of your head with things going on. And every writer that I know was like, oh my God, that's me. And every non-writer was like, what are you all talking about? And so maybe that's...
And then there was later one about some people can imagine pictures and some people see no visual images
right.
in their brains.
Interesting.
And I really kind of want to be someone with no inner monologue and no pictures. It sounds very peaceful.
Maybe that's what all the meditation apps are for.
I know a brilliant writer who told me she has no inner monologue, but she builds stories piece by piece visually. Like their colors, and she builds them together, and she can't write the story until she's built the whole thing like blocks. And once she has it, then she writes the whole draft out. She can't do it till then.
What are some of the stories that, you know, you mentioned Gone with the Wind, what are some of the stories that you, whether you were represented in some way, or whether you just somehow something spoke to you in them, what were some of the stories that were influential in your lives?
I think I'm a writer not because I have a literature degree, but because I studied Russian Lit in college and love it as much as I'd like to say, oh, I'm a writer because of Gogol. That's not my writing at all. I think I'm a writer because I studied magic tricks as a kid. Hmm. I took magic classes, cause and effect, patter, distraction, awe, like all of those things I think are my story and writing DNA. I think I'm a writer because of Hawaiian mythology, which I grew up in with my family, family of storytellers, and the Boxcar Children and Encyclopedia Brown were my everything. And I think I'm always rewriting those stories. There's always some sort of mystery. I find Encyclopedia Brown extremely homoerotic. As a scholar, Encyclopedia Brown, Encyclopedia and Bugs Meany, there's many moments of observation of one another that might inspire me. And the Boxcar Children are kids who feel like outsiders, who are just kind of like building a life of their own outside the status quo. And when I look at my work, oh, and Go Ask Alice. I was reading Go Ask Alice to my wife last year, who's never read it. And I read some passages aloud, and I was like, oh, this silly book that was, you know, kind of a hoax book growing up. And I stopped reading, and we both looked at each other, and she goes, that's your voice. Like, you've picked up your ear from being a kid reading this book obsessively, that even syllable by syllable and the way the sentences were constructed, my writing is not like Go Ask Alice, but there's something in the ear that I still see when I read those early stories of Boxcar Children, Encyclopedia Brown, and something about, I think, the scale and the magic that still has to do with the construction of magic tricks and also the mythology that surrounded me when I was a kid.
I'm going to go look up Encyclopedia Brown fan fiction after this. Because now you've got me.
They're all by me.
And now we see where the writing, we're really all beginning. How about you, Rowan? Where did you see yourself in words?
I think maybe that is something I learned to do as I got older. I think when I was a child, I read obsessively. I used to steal books from my school library. I would give them back, but we had a limit, and I read too fast, and so at the end of the term, I would like put them in a pillowcase and then like leave them outside on the library and run away. Anyway,
it was Rowan's story.
You need to send the library a note now explaining that that's what you did. They've probably been wondering.
Because I just used to hide them up my jumper when I was taking them out. I wasn't that subtle, I think. She knew. She must have known. Anyway, and at that age, I was just reading, like, drinking water. It was like, I just wanted stories. They didn't have to be about me. They could be about, they were almost always about some plucky young boy in magic. And that was fine by me at the time, you know, like, and it was actually, and I sort of started reading people like Vonnegut and Agatha Christie, where it's not about children, but there's no like Updike and sad marriages yet. Because I wasn't interested in sad marriages, because I was like 13 and my parents had their own sad marriage, and I didn't have to think about that. I didn't want to say that on camera. Anyway.
Big unhappiness in Connecticut.
But I think there were moments. There's a book, 20 Fragments of a Ravenous Youth by Xiaolu Guo, and she was writing about like in China, and it is quite fragmented and angry, and there's so much feeling and the climates are so difficult. And I remember being like 20 and reading it and being like, this is everything I've ever felt and want to make. And I'm partially saying this because I found a good interview for soon. I'm very excited. Anyway, but I think of writing, reading as a writer as sort of a magpieing, of finding the thing that excites you. I'm really, like, I really love detective fiction. I don't write detective fiction, but I think in terms of the why. Like, you know, detective novel, why was that person murdered? And, like, my first book is, like, this woman left her son. Why did that happen? Mm-hmm. And in my second book, starts with a woman on a bridge. And it's the fallout of the police pickup. So I have this like detective novel brain in me, even though like I really want to write about like identity and feelings and, you know, paint colors.
You're still solving something.
Yeah. I can fit some from here and there.
Yeah, I always tell students, like, the idea, the literary snobbishness of these are the things that should be influential, I just find so problematic, because I do believe in writing and artists and story DNA being those things that excited us to begin with. And I'm so, like, and maybe that's an episode of The Bachelor, and I think there's merit in looking at anything if you're an artist or writer, and watching an episode or reading the detective novel and saying, like, what's the craft happening here? How are we still turning the pages? Why are we still watching? Because there is something going on in the editing, in the lens, and whatever it is that's keeping us engaged. And what is that thing, and how can we use it? So yeah, I think if you're writing detective novels, I'm still writing the Encyclopedia Brown mysteries, and they don't look the same, but we can take things from everything we enjoy and, like, use that for our own story.
And, like, when we were doing this student funding, I was thinking, like, I was saying it, like, I'm an authority, but I was, like, also just thinking about it at the time, was that, like, there were writers like, I love Richard Yates, he's an old white man, and I love him, he's great. And that I think for a while I had to go through this phase of, like, loving him, and then, like, rejecting writers like that to make space to write about people who didn't look like they were from Connecticut, and then, like, being able now to go back to the stories and be like, I love what you did there, and to be able to feel like you can take what you need from those places feels really important to me.
Well, and being able to separate what you loved about the work with the obligation to revere or to idolize or some idea of respect,
mm-hmm.
a writer, that you can love someone's work and still quibble with it and still argue with it and still interrogate it.
For sure, and we can write in response to those works.
Yeah.
We don't have to copycat the work because, you know, the person's on a pedestal. We can write in response, we can write in resistance to those works, but they're still important for us to read to do that. Right?
Yeah.
And even thinking about, I think about teaching lineage a lot and how Richard Yates was the teacher of Christine Scutt, who was one of my favorite short story writers, and I learned to write sentences from Christine Scutt. So what does it mean that she learned from Richard Yates and Jordan and Gordon Lish, who I find on camera?
What was the word from a few minutes ago? Problematic.
But I think that's interesting. Like, what's in the syntax? What's in the rhythm? What's thematically happening that's been passed on through time as this kind of memory stutter, this echo that we can pick up in our work and reject in our work? And that's interesting to me. And I don't think we should dismiss what came before or by the people who don't look like us. It feels too simple.
So who are some of the writers working right now, some of your peers, your friends, people you know of, that we should all look up and be excited about and add to our incredibly tall stacks of books next to our bedside tables?
Every time I'm asked this question, it's like I've only read one book in my life. Like, Encyclopedia Brown.
We're going.
I mean, I will just start listing people who are in this book because it's on my list, like many of my favorite writers. But I think there's a nonfiction book called The Collected Schizophrenias by Esme Waiter-Wong, which if you hadn't read it, you maybe should. It's beautiful and it's smart and it's emotional. So definitely go read that.
Who else? Alexander Chee.
And then in Chee.
Both love Alexander Chee.
Yes. Has written quite a lot. He's written a book called The Queen of the Night. He's written a book called Edinburgh. And he's written a book of essays called, I've written an autobiographical novel.
Linda Berry is probably my favorite writer of all time, who Rowan actually worked with at Madison. She's a Filipino writer, and she does graphic novels and comics, and wrote my favorite novel of all time called Cruddy.
She wrote with a paintbrush.
She did. Painted every letter. But everything by Linda Berry. Her craft book, Syllabus, What It Is. If you need writing prompts and creative prompts, she's amazing for that as well.
What It Is.
Kawhi Strong Washburn. I'm reading Sharks in the... It's really good. It's new. I don't even know if it's out yet. I think I have a galley. Sharks in the Time of Saviors, about the islands of Hawaii, and it's amazing. It's so good. The language had me literally crying in a couple of pages, and I had never read his work before, and it's really incredible. It's got a big shark on the cover, and it's bright orange. So that's a new book.
Oh, we can play this game all night. there is a book called Ponty by a writer named Charlene Teo, who lives in Britain, but it's about Singapore, and she's Singaporean, and it's about, like, horror movies and, like, creepy mothers and, like, creepy weird best friends where you kind of hate each other and kind of love each other. And it's, like, funny and weird, and one of the characters thinks she has a tapeworm. Anyway, I love it.
No, we ask everyone who comes through here, you know, who do you love from the past and who do you love working now? Because it's so important to kind of see, you know, and sometimes it comes to people while we're talking that, like, there's a through line of who I used to love to read and who I still love to read, even though the faces and the names have changed.
Someone from the past, her name is Heather Lewis. She's also one of the most important writers in my life. She wrote a book called House Rules. She wrote a full trilogy, but her work after House Rules wasn't really accepted by publishing because it was really dark. It was about sex work and depression, suicide, sexual abuse within the family. Just so, so dark. But she was a brilliant writer. She unfortunately took her own life before the books were published. Only House Rules was published. And then her kind of queer squad of people who supported her and her work got the books posthumously published, this book called Notice, which is incredible, and her trilogy is perhaps the most important collection of work in my whole life. I had never read about queerness in that way before I read Heather Lewis, and she's someone who I think is really historically overlooked, who's really important to me. And there's also, just to give a shout for a book coming out next month, especially because books are, I think, going to struggle in the next few weeks, especially things coming out. There's something called Godshot by Chelsea Beaker. It's a cult novel, and it's incredible. It's one of the best books I've read in the past decade, easy, or in my life. It's really, really, really good. And it's about environmental collapse as well, so it feels really perfect for right now.
Relevant.
Yeah.
Well, would you like to read some of your own work here tonight? We were talking earlier about passages, and we would love to hear you read what you've chosen.
Sure.
Would you like to read first? Okay, from the anthology.
Okay. Reading from the Go Home Anthology. I'm going to read just a little bit from an essay I have in here called Chicken and Stars, which also appears, Rowan was so generous to publish it in this early stage. A slightly different revised version appears in my book as a chapter, and it's a real downer. I think my book is a little funnier than this section.
I really like this section.
So I'll just read maybe two pages. So the piece is about, it's nonfiction. It's about my parents who were struggling with drug addiction at the time. And it's a story about domestic abuse. So this picks up in the middle. He's asleep on the couch when we arrive home. This is his place in our house. My father has never been a bedroom father, a kitchen father, a backyard father, an office father, a roof father. He is the father of the living room couch. I wonder if he was always this way with his other family, that other life none of us are supposed to mention. He keeps a worn photo of two boys in the slip of his wallet, boys in the sun playing ball. Even though their faces are crinkled as petals, I can see that they still have his nose. Now my father is face down on the pink leather cushions, and I sit down next to him. His left arm dangles. I lift it and let it drop. He feels dead to me. I love him more than anyone I've ever met. Beneath his arm on the floor is a crown-sized ashtray overflowing with orange filters. It's almost beautiful this way, like an exotic flower or a bloomin' onion from the outback. When my father is too drunk to walk or drive, he lights each and every butt in this ashtray. He sucks at them between his fingers like he's drinking a milkshake through a cocktail straw. Around the couch are several empty vodka bottles, a cracked cobalt glass, $100 bills, a smashed mirror. My father isn't moved no matter how much I touch him. I watch my mother fill up a cup with water from the kitchen sink, holding steady to the counter. We use well water here. It smells like cheese water, the kind that collects in the refrigerator drawers, so we plug our noses to drink. My mother points over to our pantry, and I walk over to it. The white door hangs off its hinges like a loose tooth. The shelves inside are split perfectly in half. That's where my face went, she says, all the screws yanked from the walls. I lift a can of Campbell's soup from the pile of them on the floor, chicken and stars, twist it around in my hand. It is easier to look at your favorite soup than it is at blood. Campbell's soup, my every meal, the first thing I learned how to make for myself. A can of Campbell's is exactly 1 pound. It says so on this label, and this is the measurement by which I weigh everything else in this world. I weigh 81 soup cans. My mother stares into the pantry, shaking her head. She slips slow and gently from her glass, careful not to spill. What's all this? I say. My mother points to each shelf, and there are noises now, words coming out between the cry, money, investments, snapped, pushed, and then soup cans, the money. I ask her to slow down. She says my father's been binging his special stuff and hasn't slept in over 3 days. The fight started in the kitchen, simple at first, before he took her by the wrists and didn't know what to do with all his love. She says things like this all the time lately, words like love to describe our suffering. She doesn't know if I'm old enough to hold the truth in my hands, to measure that. I hug my mother at the kitchen sink, let her cry into my shoulder. She leaves black and blue and red there on my white, crisp school uniform. I'm only 5'2", but we are the same size already. From a slight distance, people mistake us for sisters. I send my mother to her bedroom and tell her I will heat up 2 cans of Campbell's soup for dinner. I pluck them from the top of the pile. I crank the can opener till the aluminum exhales. I smash the pots and pans around, bang them into each other like gongs. The stove coils drop red. The stars boil. I open and close the dishwasher in a crashing swing like I'm bowling. I want my father to wake up so badly, for him to tell me his side of the story, to bury his head in his hands, apologizing, changed. He doesn't move. I'll stop there. It's a funny book.
I'm going to read a bit from this book, Starling Days, which is looks like this in Britain. It actually will look different in America. It is coming out.
It's coming out really soon, and this is the book to pre-order. It's so good. I wish you were here tonight.
Well, my first book is, if you want, to make me very happy. But I thought I would read from it because I wanted, I guess, for you guys to get to know me a bit as a writer, because I talked about my editing project. And so this is very shortly after the beginning, so all you really need to know is that Mina is standing on George Washington Bridge and looking down. The river was as dark as poured tarmac. They said that when a body fell into water from this height, it was like hitting sidewalk. The Golden Gate had nets to stop jumpers. She imagined the feeling of a rope cutting into arms and legs. Your body would flop like a fish. How long did they have to lie there before someone scooped them out? There was nothing like that here. People said that drowning was a good death, that the tiny alveoli of the lungs filled like 1,000 water balloons. She lifted one purple flip-flop and dropped him over the water. She didn't hear it hit. The shape simply vanished into the black shadow. That was when the lights got brighter and the voice, male and certain, lobbed into her ears. Ma'am, step away from the rail. The police car's lights flashed blue and white and red. Once she'd had an ice pop those colors, and the sugary water had pooled behind her teeth. Ma'am, step away from the rail. Good evening, officer. Have I done something wrong? Mina asked. Please get into the car, he said. There were two of them. The other was younger, and he was speaking into a radio. It was hard to make out his words over the wind and traffic. Was he talking about her? This is a public walkway, Mina said. It was open. I haven't done anything wrong. Ma'am, get into the car. I don't want to get into the car. Look, I was just getting some air. I was thinking I'll go home now. Ma'am, don't make me come over there. Mina had never been in a police car. She'd read once that the back doors only open from the outside. Who knew what would happen if she got into the car? The window was rolled down and the cop stuck his head out. There was a lump on his upper lip, a pimple perhaps. Where are your shoes? It's hot out, she said. Where are your shoes? I don't want to tell you about my shoes, she said. I haven't done anything wrong. I'm an American citizen. Ma'am, where are your shoes? She lifted up the single flip-flop she had left. The other one broke, she said. Behind him, other cars continued into the night. Did they even notice her standing in the dark, a small woman with bare legs and feet? She was aware of the bluing bruise she'd caught banging her knee on the subway door. In the shower that morning, she'd skipped shaving her legs. In the beam of his headlamps, could he see hairs standing up in splinters? Ma'am, I really need you to get into the car. I can't leave you here. What if something happened to you? In his voice, she heard the insinuation that normal women, innocent women, didn't walk alone on bridges at night. I'm fine, she said. Mina knew her stubby ponytail was frizzy. Bleaching black to Marilyn Monroe blonde had taken 4 rounds of peroxide. Now it stood up in breaking strands. If she conditioned it, would this cop think she was sane? If she blow-dried it, would he let her go home? And of course, there were the tattoos twining up her arms. We can talk about it in the car, he said. His shadowed friend was bent over the radio, lips to the black box. Mina was tired. It was the heat, or perhaps the wind. So she got into the car. The seat was smooth. Someone must have chosen the fabric specially. This must be wipeable and disinfectable. People probably spat on this seat. They probably pissed on purpose and by mistake. Between the front and back seats was a grill. She would not be able to reach out to touch the curve of the cop's ear or straighten his blue collar. The flip-flop lay across her knees. The cops wanted to know her name, address, phone number, and social security. She gave them. We're taking you to Mount Sinai, said the cop. I was just going for a walk, clearing my head. I don't need to be in hospital. I was just clearing my head. Damn, repeating yourself is a habit of the guilty. Mina tried to slow her breath. See it from my point of view, he said. You're walking alone on the bridge at night. I can't let you out. I don't know what would happen. Only then did she understand they must do this every night. Drive back and forth across the bridge, looking for people like her. Thank you. There are more lighthearted moments. She read it. It's true.
Thank you both for your stories, for your time, for being here with us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Tune in next Monday on Bob Dylan's birthday to hear Sean Latham, director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies, discuss his legacy and the new essay anthology, The World of Bob Dylan. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.